Science Friday is supported by the Planetary Society, co-founded by Carl Sagan, led today by Bill Nye. The Planetary Society is a global nonprofit that exists for anyone to take a role in advancing space exploration. When you become a member, you join their mission to explore worlds, find life off Earth, and protect our planet from dangerous asteroids. Anybody can join, find your place in space, and become a member today at planetary.org/science. Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Science Friday is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. That's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
What did it take to put the personal in personal computing?
Hello, I'm Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag.
40 years ago today, the Apple Macintosh was unveiled. It's Wednesday, January 24th, but my calendar app says it's Science Friday. I'm sci-fi producer Charles Bergquist. When Steve Jobs unveiled the Apple Macintosh in January of 1984, the visual user interface, all-in-one design, and mouse-controlled navigation were revolutionary. On the 30th anniversary of the Macintosh, Ira spoke with design team member Andy Hertzfeld and industry observer Stephen Levy about the early days of personal computing and how the Macintosh came to be. This conversation was recorded in 2014.
30 years ago this week, Super Bowl viewers saw an ad that would become an icon, a commercial produced by Ridley Scott.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
And then, 30 years ago today, the first of many showy onstage product introductions for Steve Jobs.
Now, we've done a lot of talking about Macintosh recently. But today, for the first time ever, I'd like to let Macintosh speak for itself.
Hello, I am Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag. And accustomed as I am to public speaking, I'd like to share with you a maxim I thought of the first time I met an IBM mainframe. Never trust a computer you can't with. Obviously, I can talk, but right now, I'd like to sit back and listen. So it is with considerable pride that I introduce a man who's been like a father to me, Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs promised that his new computer would be unlike any other, a computer for the rest of us. What made the Mac so different? How could it have created such a close-knit following that it divided the world into, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC? That's what we'll be talking about this hour, and I'm delighted to have two guests who were present at the creation of the Macintosh. Stephen Levy, senior writer for Wired, author of the book Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, The Computer That Changed Everything. Also just out, The Macintosh is 30, and I was there for it, its birth. It's on the Wired.com. Welcome back, Steve.
Thank you.
Also with us is Andy Hertzfeld. He's a software engineer who was a member of the original Macintosh design team. He wrote the book Revolution in the Valley, the insanely great story of how the Mac was made, sharing some of his behind-the-scenes stories of the development of the Mac. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, glad to be here.
Both joining us from Stanford University. Were you guys at that first demo?
Yeah, you bet.
I wasn't. I finished my story for Rolling Stone. So I was in New York sort of tracking it. Unfortunately, no one was live tweeting it.
I was scared. Yeah. I was scared to death our demo was going to crash.
Were you? It was about 30 years ago exactly to this hour it would have been going on Pacific time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You were scared it was going to crash.
Yeah, as it did many times in rehearsal.
So Steve was sort of afraid himself, or was he extremely confident?
Yeah,
that
he was. I'm sure he was quite nervous.
Yeah. Steve, you're right that in Wired that the minute you first met the Mac, you knew it would change the lives of millions of people. How did you know?
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, you have to put yourself in a mind frame of where we were 30 years ago, and so many people, use computers now, and of course they're not 30 years old even, but back then it was the very primitive times. We were like almost like cave people. The computers we used, which weren't very popular then, they were just popular among a small group of enthusiasts or hardcore IT people. And they had these green phosphorescent letters. It was very hard to control. You had to learn these incantations to make things happen. There were these things of you had to worry about like modes. Am I in the editing mode? Am I in the writing mode? And there comes Macintosh. And I remember very clearly the woman who gave me the first demo the day I visited the Mac team in November 1983, pulled this beautiful thing out of the box. It was a computer you could lift and turned it on. And immediately it was like a published document. There was, dark text on the screen. It started off with a smile, and you could manipulate the text like almost like a magical printing press. And I realized this is actually a natural way to do things. It was just easy to move things around. There were none of these complicated modes. And I said, I want one, and I think a lot of people are, and this is the better way to do things.
Andy, how much of the success of Mac do you think was due to these little parts of the friendly image, the icon that smiled when you booted up, the sad Mac face when something went wrong, even the bomb, I remember,
the
bomb. How much was that all due to its success due to that humanizing of the machine?
Yeah, some of it was due to its personality and spirit. But really, the main thing was we really loved the user. We cared about the user. We wanted them to have a great experience. The Macintosh was really the first affordable computer that really cared about ease of use, that really tried to meet the user on their terms rather than making the user work on its terms.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen Levy, how crucial was Steve Jobs to this? Is they basically synonymous here?
I don't know, 100% synonymous there. In the Venn diagram, he covered a lot of shade, but not 100%. And when I did the story, I was writing for Rolling Stone, documenting it. I found myself in the middle of this controversy that had occurred about the original person who started the Macintosh team had been forced out, and he was unhappy about it. And I got an earful from him about it, and and did discuss this with Steve Jobs when we finally had an interview. But I think it's undeniable that Steve Jobs was the impresario. He was the person who had the last word about what we saw. He was the person who drove Andy and the rest of them to the finish line on this. So I think he deserves a major, major share of credit for that.
Andy, how were you recruited and all the other people? How did you get to this project and did you seek it out?
Yeah, I sought it out. The Macintosh was a tiny little research project at Apple when I started in the summer of 1979. The first thing was I met Burl Smith, the hardware designer of the Mac. I became good friends with him, started helping him with some demos. I was jealous that it wasn't my job to work on the Macintosh. I was just helping him a little bit on the side. And then in February of 1981, there was a big management shakeup at Apple where they fired my manager. And I took that opportunity to ask, hey, maybe I could go work on the Macintosh with Burl and Bud. And so that's how I got started. There's a story I tell in my book about when Steve finally decided. At first, when I met with Steve and he goes, are you any good? Are you good enough to work on the Mac? We only want really good people. And so then he decided I was good enough, and he came by my cubicle and he said, I'm taking you to start work on the Mac. And I said, well, just give me a day or two to finish up the stuff I was doing for the Apple II. And he said, no. And he unplugged my computer, causing me to lose the work I was doing, and just carried it away. And what could I do but follow him?
And I should add that Andy is really, really good. Steve made a great choice there. And he's had a great career at the Macintosh and afterwards.
Was Steve like that? Would he be the kind of guy who walk up to your desk and rip out your computer and get your attention that way?
Yes. Steve was the master of dramatic gestures.
Any others you could share with us?
Oh, sure, all the time. I mean, one thing that's relevant now is he really foretold the future, how he drummed into us how important the work we were going to be doing. We were all excited anyway because we loved the Apple II, and we saw a chance to bring the joy we found in the Apple II wasn't accessible to most people because it was just too complicated to use. So we thought we could, you know, be doing a really good thing for the world. But it was Steve who just hammered it into us how important it was, and that really made us work that much harder. But there's all kinds of stories about Steve doing amazing things. Bruce Orne has a story. When he started on the Macintosh, we needed a Lisa, Macintosh's ancestor, to develop software for the Mac, and he didn't have one. And so Steve told him to go get one, to take one, steal one right off the desk of John Couch, who was running the Lisa team.
Wow. But this was a great leap of faith on Jobs' part and your part, that something like this is a totally different way of doing things.
Not really. We didn't think of it as a leap of faith. It was obvious to us once we got it going. It was so much a better way. So there were some risky aspects, but not really in the core paradigm. It was better. We knew it. We knew it from the very beginning. We still believe it now.
Science Friday is supported by the Planetary Society. Co-founded by Carl Sagan, led today by Bill Nye, the Planetary Society is a global nonprofit that exists for anyone to take a role in advancing space exploration. When you become a member, you join their mission to explore worlds, find life off Earth, and protect our planet from dangerous asteroids. Anybody can join, find your place in space, and become a member today at planetary.org/science.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Mm-hmm. And Steve, there's the mythology of Apple that the early days it was a computer club, it was made in a garage. Well, none of that is true.
No, that is true. Apple came out of the homebrew computer club. Woz designed the Apple II not to make money or as a product, but to impress his friends at the homebrew club.
But by the time you got to the Mac, it had a lot more money in the company. It was not a garage company.
That's right. It was a public company by then, and everyone wanted to see what Apple was going to do next. By that time, the IBM PC had been introduced, and that was very, very, very popular. And it was threatened to eclipse the Apple II, and in fact, it did. And it really became a question of, was Apple's next computer going to be able to compete with the IBM PC? And when I did my Rolling Stone story for the launch of the Mac, it was very clearly, this young team of designers against the big bad IBM. And when I interviewed Steve, he framed it in just that way. He said, if we don't stop IBM, no one is going to do that. And that's why we saw that commercial that, yeah. The evil empire was clearly supposed to be IBM.
And where did the phrase "the computer for the rest of us," was that Steve's idea?
I'm not sure who exactly thought it up. I think it was probably Steve Hayden at Try It Day, but certainly Steve
embraced
it.
Public relations firm, yeah.
No, they were the advertising firm who created the 1984 commercial as well as lots of other stuff.
Did that phrase catch on immediately?
I think so, but I'm not sure.
I think it did, and and sometimes it. As things often do, when Apple didn't live up to that, it was thrown back in Apple's face.
Really? In what way?
I've heard it called the computer for the rich of us.
Yeah, like that.
I see.
It cost more than right. I think Annie will confirm the team wanted, and it cost more than Steve wanted it to cost. The board, Apple's board, decided to price it, much higher than the competition because they said, well, it's better, people will buy it, and initially we're going to sell all we can make. But it was a start that took Mac a long time to catch up in the marketplace.
I will be right back. Our number 844-724-8255, talking with Stephen Levy, Andy Hertzfeld, about the 30th anniversary of the Mac. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the creation of the Apple Macintosh. 30 years ago, announcement today. My guests are Stephen Levy of Wired, Andy Hertzfeld, a member of the original Macintosh design team. Our number, 844-724-8255. Andy, some people criticize Steve and Apple for what they see as taking credit for the main new introduction, the new feature of the Mac, which was the mouse, which was developed at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center Park. Is that being overly critical?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Steve never claimed to have invented the mouse or the basic underlying technology. What Steve deserves enormous credit for was realizing that it was the right way to do things, adopting it. Also, one of the things that Apple does deserve credit for is going to the one-button mouse. The Xerox software that we originally saw had three different buttons, which always created a confusion. Well, which button should I use in this case? We simplified it down to one button, so there was no question about what you needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Dave in Pittsburgh. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Ira. Enjoy your show and enjoy your guests today. Back when I was a young teacher, I would go to these clubs, computer clubs, and people would bring Macs and Apple IIe's, and I could never afford either, but I borrowed one from school. Soon the buzz became, hey, there's this other system out there, the PC. My question is, how did IBM let the PC become public, and why did Apple keep their architecture private? Can you answer that?
Good questions. Thanks for calling. Yeah. Still to this day.
Well, there's degrees of openness. And the Macintosh sought third-party developers. It was very open to the extent that anyone in the world, if they wanted to, could write software for it. The reason we didn't make it open hardware-wise was we wanted the Macintosh to be simple and easy to use. And it gets very, very complicated if you allow people to add additional hardware, then you get into issues of configuring the drivers. I mean, I think sometimes in the PC world, it's kind of a nightmare just to get everything working and keep it working.
There was a brief period, I remember building one, when you could build a Mac on third-party hardware. Apple allowed this to happen.
And it didn't really go
very far. It was awful, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, the stuff was, it didn't really cost much less. And it was it didn't work as well as the Apple ones. And when Steve Jobs came back to Apple in 1997, he pulled the plug on that program and went back to his original instincts that he had for the Macintosh. And I think he did pretty well with that.
Do you think that the Mac and the OS 7 are going to meet somewhere in the middle, you know, your cell phone and your program?
I think that, you know, we're in a really interesting time now. You know, the Macintosh was, I think, you know, thrust us into this new world of, you know, computing, where it was visuals, called the graphical user interface. And I think actually it lasted probably longer than a lot of people thought, maybe even too long, considering how much computers improve. And I think for the last few years, we're finally seeing an evolution out of that phase, as you know, we're excited about the new ways we control computers on devices like phones and tablets. And what's happening is, what Apple's doing is it's developing the Macintosh operating system by bringing in pieces of that device system, that iOS system, into it there. Similarly, Microsoft is devising its Windows system by borrowing from its phone system there. So I think we're seeing finally, you know, an evolution really based on people's mobile use of computers.
Mm-hmm. Andy, tell us about the time you had to demo the Macintosh to Bill Gates.
Well, people forget it now, but Microsoft was a key partner of Apple in creating the Macintosh. We were counting on them to create many of the initial applications. They were the first developer. I remember the first time we gave them a Mac, which was after we demoed it to it. I felt kind of wistful that it was leaving our nest, our little baby, for the first time. Microsoft got the very first one. But anyway, it turns out you needed, at the time, which was July 1981, you needed a Lisa just to load programs for the Macintosh. But the Lisa group did not allow Bill Gates, did not want Bill Gates to see the Lisa. The Lisa was still an unannounced product. And Apple, for the Lisa, was taking a different strategy of writing all the applications themselves. So we had a 25-foot-long cable going from an office with a closed door with the Lisa to the Mac. And I was running back and forth, hitting keys on the Lisa to download the software and then back to the Mac and show it. But when we were demoing the Mac, Bill asked a question about how the cursor worked. And Bill Gates, in my observation, didn't like to be told things. He wanted to figure it out and get us to confirm it. And so he asked, what kind of hardware do we have to drive the cursor? Because he assumed that the hardware was doing the work, but really it was the software. And so I was about to tell him that, where Steve didn't like me telling that. So he just yelled out, "Shut up!" at the top of his voice to drown me out. And Bill knew something was going on there, but not quite what.
You know, that's true, that people do forget that Microsoft supplied the first really useful tool, writing tools and calculus tools and the Office sort of suite to the Mac.
That's right.
To this day, if you talk to Bill Gates, he will not let you forget it. he says, you know, repeatedly says, "We had more people working on Macintosh software than Apple did." I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, because we wanted to keep our software team as small as we could because we cared so much about the quality. And so, you know, we had about 10 people. I don't know how many he had. But, of course, Apple had more people working on the total Macintosh because software was only part of it.
Who was responsible for the whole look and feel of the screen, those, you know, the faces and bombs and all that kind of stuff?
It was a team effort, but yeah. Susan Kerr was the artist. She was my friend from high school. I knew we were developing a graphical computer, and so we needed some graphical talent. Susan has a tremendous sense of humor. She's incredibly bright. So she was a perfect match for us. She started in 1983 and designed all the icons and fonts for the Macintosh. But what I would say is the overall look and feel was a consensus of the team. Steve Jobs played a huge part at being the ultimate decision maker. He was the one who tell us it was good enough or not. More often, it wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. But then Bill Atkinson, you got to mention him. He was really the key visionary and designer of the basic user interface, mainly for the Lisa. He was on the Lisa team. But we took almost everything Bill did for the Macintosh.
And Andy had a big role in that, too. One of the, you know, delights that I had the first day I met the Macintosh was meeting Andy and Bill there. And I was later to learn about their tremendous impact they had on it. Andy's one of those rare engineers that, you know, fits that Steve Jobs model of liberal arts meeting engineering there. You know, he gets both sides.
Science Friday is supported by the Planetary Society. Co-founded by Carl Sagan, led today by Bill Nye, the Planetary Society is a global nonprofit that exists for anyone to take a role in advancing space exploration. When you become a member, you join their mission to explore worlds, find life off Earth, and protect our planet from dangerous asteroids. Anybody can join, find your place in space, and become a member today at planetary.org/science.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Every memory you think you have of the past.
The house you grew up in. Your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Sounded like you know that your network of close friends was open for the taking for job wise, you know, people, small company.
Sure, but they had to be good enough, and that, yeah. No one could work on it because they were your friend. But if they had the right talent and could help us, sure.
Steve, does Apple still have the Macintosh-ness, the Apple-ness from those early days? Do you think?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's a much bigger company now, but I think they really do try to cultivate that specialness there in what they do. That's really what distinguishes them from other companies there. For a long time, it's kind of funny. Apple sort of tried to distance itself from its most rabid fans. They thought, well, we're a serious company, and we're not going to cater so much to these people. And Apple, they didn't really develop the game market for Macintoshes and other things there. And I think that though Apple now reaches a much bigger audience there, I sense that they do try to make the most of the intense interest of them. And you see, leading up to every introduction, there's this elaborate dance between the rumors places and Apple there, which I think benefits both sides.
Does the Mac still have an advantage with this new interface it had brought on like it did years ago? Certainly that is not something that's exclusive to the Mac anymore.
Well, Windows, was, I think, emulated a lot of what happened in the Macintosh. From Bill Gates' point of view, he said they were both borrowing from Xerox. So what's the difference? But I don't think you would have seen Windows develop the way it was if it wasn't for the Macintosh there. But I think Apple tries in its way to get things just right and present that delight to what it does.
And Apple retains the original advantage of making both the hardware and software in concert. Mm-hmm. Microsoft's model was successful in a business sense, but not as successful in a product sense, because it was much harder to innovate when you had to coordinate many different companies and achieve consensus with them, whereas Apple is still in control of the whole thing, the hardware, the software, the marketing, and can make an integrated, beautiful experience. It seems to me that the iPhone and the iPad, incredibly successful today, but they're the culmination of the Macintosh. They are on that same line. That really didn't even start with the Macintosh. In my mind, it started with the Apple II, and that certain amazing spirit of the Apple II. And I see that in the iPad, and I expect to see it in future Apple products years from now.
Well, why didn't Steve Jobs just continue with the Apple II line? What was the impetus to say, I've got to try something totally different, something in...
The technology. The Apple II had an 8-bit microprocessor that could only address 64K bits of RAM. It was bound to be obsolete in just a few years because of the unrelenting progress in the underlying silicon. That's what's really so exciting about the technology industry, is everything needs to be reinvented every decade or so.
Mm-hmm. And was that the insane? You both, in both of your books, you use the phrase "insanely great." Is that what was the insanely great part? If you could sum that up.
Well, that phrase was Steve's phrase.
Yeah.
But the insanely great part was, here was a computer that, with very little preparation or effort, you can figure out to use, just sitting down in front of it with no instruction.
I think also it says something about Steve Jobs and the demands he made on his team there. He said to me, other people, they do things, they try to be great, but we have to be insanely great. It shows the standard he set was a standard that, maybe even, some people on the team thought they couldn't even reach, but that's what he demanded. So they worked up to it.
What's also interesting about the Mac, even the original Mac, is that it was made to be networked. It was made to be hooked up on a network, where the original PC was supposed to sit there in your laptop, right on your desktop. And whose decision? What kind of design decision was that? Was that purposely put there to make it a business environment? To say the Mac?
No, what was it for?
Well,
that was really Burl Smith, the hardware designer for the Macintosh. We discovered this serial communications chip that gave us the serial ports that we needed to talk to printers and modems. But the cool thing about that chip is you could also do a local area network with it. And so we incorporated that chip. It took us another year or two to develop the networking software. But a guy named Sidhu had a great team in 1984 and 1985 and developed AppleTalk, the first zero configuration local area network. And it took off from there.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Steve Levy and Andy Hertzfeld. Steve is the author of the book Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, the Computer That Changed Everything. You're coming out with a new edition, Steve, I understand?
Yeah, today I decided to append the transcript of the interview I did with Steve Jobs when I was doing that Rolling Stone story on the eve of the launch. It's about 11,000 words. And it really is a fascinating look into the way he was then. In some respects, he had a very consistent design philosophy, which he kept really for the rest of his life. In other senses, he was still learning how to deal with the public there. And in some senses, its role, he talks about his personal life in a way that I think he would have been more circumspect about later in life.
Mm-hmm. He had an interesting dinner with him back.
Yeah, it was fascinating. He told me if the Macintosh didn't work out, maybe he would go to Italy and race motorcycles or something.
And how can we get a copy of? Is that just a part of your new book that's going to be issued?
Yeah, just today. I'm still figuring out how to get all these places to update it. So it's today available in the Kindle edition, and it'll be available in the other e version soon. And whenever Penguin gets to implement it, then you'll see it in Dead Trees.
Andy, is Revolution in the Valley the insanely great story of how the Mac was made? Is that still in print, available?
Yeah. There's a paperback that came out in 2011 that's still in print, and of course on the Kindle or the iTunes bookstore.
Is there one myth about the Mac that we have a couple of minutes left that Steve that people think that you go around dispelling all the time? Or is that the biggest?
Well, I think people don't understand that the Mac was almost a failure. In part because of the price, in part because The team was so ambitious that they outran really the capabilities of the hardware initially. You know, like there was a period, and I was an early Macintosh user, where you had to do a lot of disk swapping to do, you know, very simple things, and you know, there was a lot of waiting, and you know, you had to pay a price for being a pioneer there. And also the IBM, the alternative, was so much less expensive that a lot of people didn't take advantage of the Mac. So it really went by the skin of its teeth to get through that period where Apple can make more powerful versions that caught on. But even so, it wasn't a market leader, really.
Andy, anything come to mind?
I'm not sure about a myth, but the Macintosh that we're celebrating today isn't really the same computer than the one we created. It's had two different processor family switches, which are very, very difficult to pull off in a software-based switching to the PowerPC CPU and then the Intel CPU. Right. And a big operating system change when it's really the Macintosh you buy today isn't the system that I helped create. It was, although that's still part of it, and it's certainly in the DNA.
What are they selling for these days if you want to pick up an original Mac?
An original Mac?
You know.
I don't know. I haven't looked. I would guess pretty cheap.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of them in the world.
Yeah, I know that if you really want a collector's item, what you want is the one with the original limited memory, 128K memory. About 6 months later, they offered an upgrade, which, you know, people like me just gobbled
up
because, you know.
We're going to go look for them today online. Stephen Levy, Andy Hertzfeld, thanks for joining us today.
And that's it for today. That was Apple design team member Andy Hertzfeld and industry observer Stephen Levy in a conversation from 2014. Next time, a look at how modern AI is helping researchers recreate a land bridge digitally and search for archaeological artifacts. I'm sci-fi producer Charles Bergquist. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.